689 Insurance Company of North America versus C Selective Inc. We have Mr. Weiss appearing on behalf of C Selective, and according to my notes, 20 minutes. And then Attorney Odorizzi will also appear for the Amicus Associated General Contractors. He is not. Mr. Weiss is a Wisconsin attorney and will introduce Michelle Odorizzi. And you've seen 5 minutes of your argument. Okay. Miss Odorizzi is a lawyer in good standing in what jurisdiction? Illinois. Motion will be granted. And then we have 30 minutes by Attorney Bascom, representing the insurance company of North America, and then rebuttal by you, Mr. Weiss. Rebuttal by you, Mr. Weiss. Okay. Mr. Weiss, you may proceed.
Thank you, Justice, Justices, Counsel. May it please the Court. My name is Monty Weiss, and with me is J.P. Fernandez of counsel to my firm. We represent Cease Electric and its insurer, Beacon Insurance Company. With me is Michelle Odorizzi from Minor Brown and John Finnerty Jr. from Michael Peston Friedrich. We represent the Amicus, American General Contractors of America. It is one of the largest trade associations of construction industries with both Wisconsin and Milwaukee chapters. As the Chief Justice has noted, I have ceded some of my time, as I believe the Court will find the oral contributions of the amici helpful to its decision-making process in this case. This case concerns the failure of a ventilation system at an egg farm that resulted in solely economic losses. Review was granted to decide two issues. The first issue was whether the economic loss doctrine applies to contracts that involve the provision of services, and second, whether the economic loss doctrine applies to mixed contracts, that is, contracts involving both a product and a service, each of which I will address in turn. It is our belief that this Court should adopt a rule of law applying the economic loss doctrine to these contracts that involve improvements to real property, provided the loss is solely economic. The economic loss doctrine is a judicially created remedies doctrine that was designed to respond to these types of cases where commercial parties entered into a contract, and in this case, an oral contract, and the loss that resulted is solely economic.
All right, could I've got a question. I wasn't really able to discern it from the briefs. Maybe I missed it. Here, this was an oral contract to acquire this whole building, egg farm, where they raised the chickens that laid eggs. Okay. What product? In other words, I know the service was wiring service, and I understand from the briefs that I can find that there was wiring, there was conduit. I know that the ventilators were purchased by Cold Spring, and your client was to wire those in so that they all work together. Other than the wire and conduit, what other product would you provide?
Client provided basically fabricating the entire system together.
There was a wiring diagram. I mean, this is something when you say fabricate, it's like somebody coming in to fabricate putting my refrigerator in or putting electric light over my bathroom. I mean, what fabricating is? What are you talking about?
What my client was given was the electronic control box, the SD4026, and a one-page wiring diagram, and was told, put together the automatic ventilation system built around this brain, this electronic brain. It took parts that Cold Spring had. It took additional parts that it may have needed, wiring of conduit. There was the backup thermostat that the plaintiffs alleged my company provided. That was part of the ventilation system. The ventilation system is essentially comprised of a fan control unit, sensors to monitor temperature, a backup thermostat, perhaps circuit breakers, wiring, conduit, and the like. In the record, my client testified that it was a system, that he had to fabricate and put in, along with the other two types of systems.
And so fabricate means that you put the wire in the ventilators and you hook it up so that it ran together, as I understand it. And the allegation on the other side is that you should have had a secondary source and it was all wired into the one source, so when the main source didn't work, the other one didn't either. But I'm just wondering about fabricating to get to a product, because I'm looking at what is a service, and if it was billed on an hourly basis, right?
Yes, that hourly basis plus parts.
Plus wire and conduit.
And, well, the record.
Now you want it. Go ahead.
Sure. And whatever else was needed that the egg farm didn't have itself.
And that's whatever else was needed was. What else was needed? That's what you
have to argue a little bit outside the record. What was
testified? Okay, well, no, just stay in the record.
Right. What was testified to is that we put together a system that we were told this is the fan control unit, this is how we want to base our system on. Everything else that is needed that we don't have yet and put together and put together a system.
Which you had a wiring diagram.
A one page wiring diagram, which was a generalized wiring diagram, was attached as one of the documents in the appendix.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Is the issue whether this is a contract for services or a mixed contract for services and goods, is that a question of law or is it a question of fact? And what did the trial court find and what did the Court of Appeals hold?
Whether or not it is a system contract for services or a contract for mixed product, I think it is somewhat of a fact-driven analysis. But the trial court concluded simply that the economic loss doctrine doesn't apply. It didn't make a determination one way or the other. In motions after, the court specifically concluded that there was it didn't need to address the economic loss doctrine. It just simply didn't apply. The Court of Appeals decided that, in its estimation, it was a product. It was a contract for services.
Okay.
The economic loss doctrine.
That was the Court of Appeals.
Correct. Okay. It applied to services. Economic loss doctrine doesn't apply to services. This was a contract for services. As a remedies principle.
Is there a third issue? In reviewing the briefs, you listed two at the introduction of your comments here this morning, but it appears there is an additional issue of whether or not this is damage to other property, and that's whether the economic loss doctrine comes to bear whatsoever in this case. Is that an issue in this case?
I don't think that it's an issue in the sense that the hens are not other property. Wisconsin law is very clear on this, that the hens would not be other property. The Harvard case speaks directly to that, where we have the silo whose representative be as keratite. It wasn't, as a result, the cows and livestock that were...
With all due respect, you're answering on the merits. I mean, you're saying it's not other property. The question is that a question that the court should reach? And the court's order indicated only two issues.
Correct.
For instance, the brief Cold Springs indicates issue three. The economic loss doctrine does not bar this tort action because there has been damage to other property.
The court did ask us to address only those two issues, whether or not it applies to contracts that involve the provision of services and to mixed contracts.
Let's just accept for a moment the premise that the economic loss doctrine applies to service contracts. How would you define the economic loss doctrine?
Excuse me, Counselor, before you answer, we are having trouble hearing you. If you'd raise the mic up, I would need to. Volume's up as high as it can go, but that'll help us to hear better.
Sure.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Could you provide a definition of the economic loss doctrine in the context of a service contract? In other words, you have to take up manufacturer and product and define it that way.
I think the economic loss loss doctrine, being a remedies principle, simply tells us whether a loss can be recovered in contract or in court. In a service contract, the economic loss doctrine would apply the same way that it would to a product. If in this particular case you would have commercial parties, a contract, solely economic loss, we would apply the terms of the contract to determine what remedies and rights would be available in the event of a breach of that contract.
But what would that be here?
Part of the, I think at best it would be simply, or possibly a return of whatever the purchase price would be. The problem is that IMA proceeded on a tort theory when I raised the contract as a defense, saying that there is a contract here and we need to look at the contract to determine your rights and remedies, including damages for any breach of that.
Well, then your answer to Justice Prosser is that there are no damages in a service contract for negligent performance of the service contract would be recovered except for damage to the property caused by the negligent services. Maybe not, but that's, I'm trying to put it in the framework. And any personal injury. I mean, to make it the same. So if the ventilation blew and injured somebody that was standing next to it, I assume being covered.
The economic loss doctrine wouldn't apply.
That's right, to that personal injury.
Right.
Okay, and then say the ventilation system just blew up and damaged the ventilation system.
If the ventilation simply blew up and damaged itself, we would look to the economic loss doctrine to limit the recovery to whatever the contract language said or whatever the agreement was between the parties, because all we have is a frustrated expectations as to a product.
What about if the ventilation system caught fire because of the way it was wired and burned the building down?
I still think that you could look to the economic loss doctrine to limit the right to recovery, because in this particular case, the ventilation system was fully integrated in the barn, became a part of the barn, and had no separate existence outside of the barn. So I think that there is a good argument that the economic loss doctrine would, again, require us to look to what the parties agreed to.
They have an oral contract. What did the parties agree to as to damages?
That is not in the record. Again, they brought a tort claim. We raised the contract as a defense, saying that we need to proceed down in contract. I attempted to get the trial court, to agree with that. They did not agree with our perspective on this. It's incumbent, I think, upon a plaintiff to bring the right cause of action. They sued in tort. They could have sued in contract. We made them aware of it prior to trial. Admittedly, shortly before trial, we raised the economic loss doctrine.
Mr. Weiss, with a contract that's oral in nature, if you're right that the economic loss doctrine applies, wouldn't you look to the UCC in terms of the remedies available?
Perhaps you could look to the UCC, but you would look
else,
to the...
Where else would you look?
You would look to the terms of the agreement between the parties.
The agreement was we're going to put in a system and you're going to pay by the hour, right?
And if the parties did not contract or have any agreement as to the remedies, that in itself is an allocation of responsibility of who is going to bear the risk of that loss. In this case, the parties, that was the defense, was that we raised this, that we need to look to the contract. Here, these two parties had a 20-year history of dealing with each other. I suspect that over 20 years, they probably had some problems with perhaps some work that my clients did, and they must have resolved it. Perhaps a course of dealing.
We are not suggesting that because there's an oral contract and there's no discussion of remedies, that therefore there is no remedy available, are you?
No, I'm saying that if there is an oral contract, there's no discussion of remedy, then in that discussion, perhaps you may have to look to a course of dealing. How do the parties treat this over their 20-year history? But perhaps the absence of a remedy under the contract is nothing more than, as the economic loss doctrine has indicated to us, is an allocation of risk that was accepted by Cold Spring. They insured against this loss. They bought a specific ventilation failure endorsement that said for absolutely any reason this ventilation system fails, we're going to be able to get recovery from INA. And INA was paid a premium for that coverage. So they've allocated for the risk of the ventilation system failing in this case.
Well, and apparently the tortfeasor doesn't get benefit of the victim's insurance. I mean, he carried collision insurance, sort of like I paid for my auto, but that doesn't protect me from suing, or the insurance company from suing the guy that damaged my vehicle.
Certainly. You're absolutely correct. It doesn't preclude him. First, you have a tort in your example, but here there was nothing stopping Cold Spring and INA from asserting a contract breach claim or a breach of whatever warranty they believe that they got from my client and seeking remedies according to
that. But in an oral service contract, I can find nothing more than the fact that your client had a relationship. It was one of electrical services and provided the electrical service. And there was, normally, if you have a contract, you have some dealing back and forth. But here, it just seems devoid of that. And the expectation that this was all something that they should insure against and there would be no loss for any negligence of providing the service just doesn't seem, a concern to me that would be the way that this would be resolved between the parties. That you could, in other words, no matter what type of service you provided, that it would be covered by the economic loss doctrine.
Whatever service we provided, we would
need was wiring. This is what electricians provided. The wiring.
Whatever service was provided, if it fits the confines of the economic loss doctrine, we don't have damage to other property, we don't have personal injuries, we have, in this case, commercial parties, a contract and solely economic loss, we look to the economic loss doctrine to simply channel the route of recovery. And channeling the route of recovery here would be channeling it into a contract claim. Assert your terms of your contract and the remedies that you're entitled to and attempt to prove those.
I hire a plumber to come in and repair a leak. I've never had any contracts or relations with this plumber before. He's to come in. He says, come in, I'll do a good job. I say, that's what I expect, that's what I'm going to pay for, right? And manages to flood my fields of plants. Destroyed them, and I'm in the business of plants, and I lose profits and lose the plants and everything else. Under straight contract law, what are my damages?
It would depend upon what the agreement was that was reached.
Just gave you the agreement.
The agreement is.
I don't have usually a written agreement with the plumber. I gave you the agreement. There it is. I mean, there are different general rules of contract damages, right?
You would lose the benefit of the bargain. Perhaps you would get a refund of the purchase price in your breach of contract.
You're not going to pay me for my plants.
No.
You're not going to pay me for my loss of profits.
No.
And that's the point about a tort damage, malpractice, because then you'd be liable for damages that are foreseeable and comfort. That's what the whole case is about, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree that the case is really about you have the contract and you look to your contract remedies, whatever they may be.
Counselor, what about if an attorney commits malpractice? We sue them all the time. We sue accountants all the time. It's just a service contract. Why is this any different than an attorney's malpractice claim, which we permit to go forward? Or do you think we shouldn't be letting those go forward either? Being a good attorney, we need to argue that one.
My answer to that is simple. This case isn't about accountants, doctors, or lawyers. But taking that, we have tort claims against doctors, under the economic loss doctrine, you've caused bodily injury, you're outside of that. Lawyers, there are tort claims, this court has stated that, and accountants, perhaps as well. We're dealing with more of the tangible product here, something that you can ward. This case isn't about doctors, lawyers, accountants. We're not looking to address or expand the economic loss doctrine to apply to them.
But why is an electrician different than an accountant? Or why is an electrician different than an architect?
Well, think the difference is that the electrician can provide a tangible product, a tangible item that we can warrant. I can warrant that when I sell a ventilation system to you, that it will not fail as a result of my installation problems or my design problems or how I put it together. I can warrant that. I can warrant that when I sell you a house or I build a house for you, that it will be that it will not have water infiltration to you. I can warrant those types of things. Those are tangible things that I can identify. We can't guarantee results as attorneys. We can't necessarily guarantee results as accountants. Those are more of the intangibles. And therefore, the rule of law we are looking for this court to apply is to limit it to improvements to real property where we do have those tangible items and something easy to warrant and to understand.
Does CESA serve residential property too?
Yes.
And with the same, assuming we adopt your position, would that apply to all residential property too?
I certainly think it can if, again, we have solely economic loss and we don't have damage to other property. It certainly could apply to those transactions. The consumer is certainly protected by various administrative code provisions. They are certainly capable of negotiating with different contractors to get perhaps better or larger warranties or better guarantees as to what they want, and they certainly are capable of buying insurance to indemnify them in the event of a loss that exceeds what the contract would be between CESA and the residential consumer.
What should be our expectations of what a residential property owner would be negotiating with an electrician or a plumber or someone else who comes in and does services?
The expectation a consumer certainly could have is, I see my time is up, do I have permission to answer the question? I guess the answer the consumer could certainly expect, saying, look, if something goes wrong and you damage my property or you don't do a good job, what are you going to do? How are you going to protect against this, or how are you going to indemnify me? And if they're not satisfied with that answer, they can do one of two things, find a different contractor, perhaps pay more, but get a different contractor who will be willing to give them perhaps a performance guarantee. Alternatively, they can have, as most homeowners do, some type of insurance to insure against that loss, just as the consumer did in the State Farm case. They had not only purchased the extra warranty from the seller, but they also had insurance to cover them from the loss subject to their deductible. You see, my time is up unless there are any other questions.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Weiss, you do have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Attorney welcome to Wisconsin.
Good morning. Thank you, Rob. I appreciate the opportunity of appearing before you today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors of America and AGC's Wisconsin chapters. Picking up on some of the questions that were asked, I think there is a very large difference between services rendered in connection with the construction contract and other types of services. As Mr. Weiss said, lawyers can't guarantee a result. But when you install a ventilation system, you can guarantee your workmanship on that system. You can guarantee a result.
Lawyers can't guarantee your result. Let's say you come to me to draft the will, and I do estate planning, and my expertise allows me to do what is oftentimes referred to as tax avoidance techniques. And let's say I don't do my tax avoidance technique all that well, and I commit malpractice. I am here giving you a will. It may or may not be considered a product. Certainly there's a service involved, right? And an attorney who does estate planning to do tax avoidance really is guaranteeing a result. That is, you don't have to pay the kind of taxes upon death that you would have to pay absent the will.
Right. If the attorney makes a mistake, it's negligence. It's not living up to the standard of care for an attorney. But ordinarily, attorneys don't write engagement letters that say, and we warrant and guarantee that you won't have to pay any taxes. But that's not ordinarily, and for most of what an attorney does, if it's litigation, for example, we certainly can't guarantee
that. But in estate planning, that's exactly what you're doing. You're guaranteeing that you're going to pass that stuff on
to your kids without the IRS taking as much as they could without
your service as an attorney. But there are uncertainties involved even in tax planning, certainly, Your Honor.
Yeah, taxes to certain things.
Counsel, I think that there are some times when attorneys miss deadlines.
Yes.
They don't file a lawsuit on time.
Absolutely.
And they've accepted a matter and said they will file a claim on your behalf. I just don't see how that's something that's not a, quote, guaranteed result.
You can't have a breach of contract against attorneys. That's true. If you have a contract to do a particular thing and then you don't do it.
That would be malpractice as well.
That's right. But here, when you have construction services, they are always intertwined in some way with a product. Here it happens to be the installation of a product. If Cease Electric had bought that fan system and supplied the entire thing and installed the product, under the Court of Appeals cases anyway, it's quite clear that the economic loss doctrine would apply because it would be predominantly for the supplying of a product. And, in fact, in a recent decision in the Court of Appeals, they said, well, if you hired a general contractor, if a general contractor had been hired to do this and Cease had been hired as a subcontractor and had done exactly what it did here, it couldn't be sued for economic loss because, in that case, the contract was between the general contractor and the owner, and it was a contract for a finished product.
It was a summer August case.
Yes, Your Honor. So where your
American versus Cascade Stone Company, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that's the case.
Rejected.
So you have the oddity of the situation is that when you break up the installation contract and you break it apart and you have a direct contract between the owner and the installer, all of a sudden the economic loss doctrine applies to them because it's a service. It's no longer predominantly a contract for the supplying of a product. And we think that just doesn't make sense because in this context of installing a product, it is quite easy for the parties to negotiate a warranty, a guarantee of workmanship. And therefore, the law should push them into a situation where that's what they ought to be doing rather than relying on tort remedies.
Well, that's in the ordinary course of business when you have an electrician come and repair or install something. I would say that this is just my viewpoint, but if you don't have a contract, you normally don't. It's something that it's oral as this is, and that's one of the what I think is concerns about extending the economic loss doctrine to that type of relationship, because we cover probably 90% of all of the dealings plumbers and electricians and others get into.
Right. But then you have the question of what is the contract between the parties? And if the contract between the parties is to perform a service, as the Chief Justice said, in a manner that is careful, appropriate, and that achieves the result you want, then you have a claim for breach of contract and whatever remedies attend to that.
Counsel, do some of the cases, not necessarily Wisconsin cases, but do some of the cases across the nation draw a distinction between commercial contracts and contracts with a residential customer?
I don't know, Your Honor. The distinction I have seen is between construction-related contracts and other contracts. They do tend to arise in the commercial area, but the Illinois Supreme Court, for example, distinguishes between contracts to install a finished product or create a finished product and other types of service contracts. But I don't know if they've gotten to the point yet.
When you're saying construction contracts, are you talking about the difference between putting up a home, as an example, and repairing the toilet?
Well, a construction-related contract, anything that relates to improvements to real property, would, I think, fall on the side of the line where you can warrant the result, and therefore that is something that ought to be the parties to contract about. But I don't know. The cases that have arisen in the economic loss doctrine have tended to be large commercial contracts. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bascom, representing Brian A.
Yes, my name is Tim Bascom. May it please the court, counsel. I represent the Insurance Company of North America and Cold Spring Egg Farm in this case. Based on the court's questioning, I'm going to depart a little bit from my prepared remarks and try and respond to some of the questions the court had of opposing counsel. Justice Wilcox, you are asking questions about whether or not there was a product that was provided along with the services in this case. The record is devoid of any reference of any product whatsoever other than contained in Exhibit Number 3, which is an invoice that was introduced by me setting forth the time that was spent by one of the employees wiring conduit to the backup thermostat. There's absolutely no evidence of any other product that was provided, whether it be something that Cease Electric needed in order to attach this system to the wall or otherwise connect the system to the fans. There's no evidence whatsoever of any other product provided in this case. This was an oral agreement between two parties, and it's clear in the record what the content of the agreement was. The people from the egg farm, Scott Hartwig, testified that they retained Cease Electric to wire this ventilation system to the Aerotech fan control device. He expected that Cease Electric would do so according to the manufacturer's instructions and in a workmanlike manner. Mr. Cease testified that the terms of the contract contemplated time and materials. There was absolutely no indication by anyone that any person ever contemplated limiting anyone's liability or responsibility in the event that the contract, I'd strike that, in the event that the system itself failed. Now,
Mr. Bascom, is there a bill that's part of the record in this case?
No, there isn't. The only invoice is the time and materials invoice, that's Exhibit Number 3. But I don't believe there's any dispute that Cease Electric was paid for its services.
Are there any materials listed on that invoice?
That invoice is the one that contains the conduit and the wire. It was a time slip sheet that Dan Boise submitted to justify the time he spent, and it included the materials that he used to wire the backup thermostat.
What about the backup thermostat itself?
There's no evidence of whether or not that was provided by Cease Electric or, in fact, was purchased by the egg farm separately, as was the Aerotech system.
So the materials that would be listed on the invoice would be conduit and wiring?
That's it. That is the entirety of the evidence as to what product was provided. Now, in Wisconsin, under the Colton case, implied in every contract for construction services is the obligation of the contractor to perform those services in a workmanlike fashion. Colton specifically says that the failure of a contractor to perform those services, and Colton uses the word negligence, negligence in performing those services constitutes a tort as well as a breach of contract. And that's what we have in this case. We have the tort of failing to properly wire the backup thermostat and then failing to test the system. And we also have a breach of contract. And I want to note that because counsel has repeatedly suggested that we were required to bring this case only in contract. Well, that's not the law in the state of Wisconsin. But I submit to you that because the negligent failure to properly perform a contract constitutes as a matter of law a breach of contract, that by pleading that Cease Electric was negligent in performing its services under the notice pleading provisions that this court has set forth, we have pled a breach of contract. This court has said that you don't need to use magic words anymore, that you don't need to label your cause of action. All you have to do is set forth the operative facts that give rise to a cause of action. And indeed, if your operative facts give rise to more than one cause of action, that's sufficient, even though it subjects the defendant to liability under multiple theories.
Now, counsel, though, you tried only a negligence action in this case. You didn't try a contract action. The jury wasn't instructed on a contract action. So, you know, So it's either negligence or nothing at this point, isn't it?
No, I don't believe that's true, Your Honor, because the pleadings and the proof and the instructions and the verdict are absolutely identical whether a party is claiming that the negligence of the contractor gives rise to a tort or the negligence of the contractor gives rise to a breach of contract. And the reason for that is really set forth in the jury instructions. If you look at the jury instructions, there's no jury instruction that identifies parties' rights and responsibilities under a service contract, but there is a jury instruction that's grounded in the negligence jury instruction that patterned after Colton. And it says, and it was given in this case, it's jury instruction 1022.4, which says that every contractor must perform the work in a reasonable fashion and must meet the standards of other reasonable contractors. The jury was instructed and found that Cease Electric was negligent in wiring this ventilation system. As a matter of law, that constitutes a breach of contract. The jury wouldn't be asked whether or not Cease Electric breached its contract. The jury would be asked whether or not Cease Electric was negligent, because under Colton, negligence in the performance of a contract constitutes a breach of contract. And nothing would have changed had the magic words breach of contract been used. The pleadings would have been the same. We would have proved negligence. The defenses would have been the same. They would have been defending it by saying that they weren't negligent. And there's absolutely no indication that there was any limitation of liability or warranty or remedy or damages contemplated by the parties. In fact, in response to Justice Abrahamson's question, there is a remedy available in contract when someone breaches the contract, and it's virtually identical to the remedy that's available in tort. And you have to remember that the damages were stipulated to in this case. There's a jury instruction, number 3710, which provides, the law provides that a person who has been damaged by a breach of contract shall be fairly and reasonably compensated for his or her loss. In determining the damages, if any, you will allow an amount that will reasonably compensate the injured person for all losses that are the natural and probable result of the breach. Therefore, if the plumber comes to your business and negligently fixes your plumbing, you do have a tort action for the damages that he causes to your plants and your lost profits, but you also have a contract action, and that's set forth in Colton.
If that's true, why are we fussing on economic loss? If what you say is right, in every contract case, they can recover all of these collateral, that is, losses.
No, and the point there is, Your Honor, that the economic loss doctrine doesn't automatically limit people's recovery. It doesn't say you cannot recover economic losses. What the economic loss doctrine says is if you have a contract where you've allocated risks and responsibilities, if you buy a product and obtain a limited warranty, or the manufacturer disclaims liability for consequential damages, we're not going to let you avoid the limitations set forth in your bargain by bringing the lawsuit in tort. That same consideration just doesn't exist in an oral contract where the parties have not attempted to reallocate some kind of loss or risk of loss, etc. You look to the contract to see whether or not the contract limits your right to recover. In this case, there's no evidence that it does. And in response, I believe it was Justice Crooks was saying, or maybe it was Justice Wilcox was saying, this is the nature of the beast. This is how these contracts are entered into on a daily basis. Owners contract with people like Cease Electric and ask them to perform electrical services and agree to pay for time and materials. No one ever attempts to limit their responsibility for loss, nor would anyone think that they were going to. You expect the contractor to stand behind his or her work, and that's exactly what Colton says they have to do. Cool. Yes?
One of the problems, if I remember, and I can't put my fingers on the case, Colton's language has been subject to some comment in the cases that would indicate that maybe that language is a little too broad.
Well, I think you might be talking about language. was a case called Landwehr that came out after Colton, and it did narrow Colton's applicability, but it doesn't mitigate against a finding that Colton is still good law when dealing with situations such as this one. In fact, Colton has repeatedly been cited as dealing with construction law, but Landwehr, if I can explain what Landwehr did. Landwehr was a case where a father had orally contracted with his son for, was going to leave his son the homestead, the farm, if the son agreed to work for a period of time at very reduced wages. And the father didn't do that. And the son brought an action based on tort and failing to properly execute the contract. And this court said that Colton stood for the proposition that where there was a duty independent of the contract, that the contract gave rise to the relationship between the parties, but if the duty existed independent of the contract, you could bring an action in tort. For example, in that case, the father had no obligation, independent of the contract, to draft a will and leave his son anything. However, with respect to a construction situation, which is what Colton was, there's an independent duty on the part of a contractor to perform the work in a reasonable fashion, whether there's a contract or whether they gratuitously attempt to repair the porch. If you undertake an action such as repairing a porch or wiring an egg farm, you must do so in a reasonable fashion, and the failure to do that results in tort liability.
Okay. You're talking here about a service contract or a mixed, are you talking about a service and product contract? Your position is this is service.
That's correct, Judge.
Not
inside justice. That's correct. This is it's our position that the record reflects that this is a service contract and that, therefore, the economic loss doctrine should not apply. And in fact, by its own definition, where there is a service contract involved, the economic loss doctrine shouldn't apply. Courts have said that where there is damage to property other than the product or damage to person, we're not going to restrict tort remedies available to the injured party. If you have a situation where there is a service contract and something goes wrong and property is damaged, unless you're willing to completely write the other property exception out of the economic loss doctrine, the economic loss doctrine can't apply because everything is other property in the context of a service contract because you haven't provided a product at all.
How do you define service contract? How do you distinguish that from a mixed contract?
I think that it would be fair to apply what the Court of Appeals did in this case, and that's the predominant purpose test. You look at the relationship between the parties and determine, is this business relationship predominantly to purchase a product or is it predominantly to provide services? In this case, the Court of Appeals undertook that analysis, and there is absolutely no question that they were right. The evidence in this case is that Cease Electric was hired because they were an electrical contractor and they were going to provide electrical contracting services. Absent the mention of some very miscellaneous wire and conduit, there's absolutely no evidence that they provided any goods in this case. And therefore, this is a pure services contract. Now, the predominant purpose test was developed under the UCC, and if in fact the court, and this is another policy issue in determining whether or not the economic loss doctrine applies to service contracts. One of the reasons that the courts have said in the context of a sale of goods case, one of the reasons the courts have been reluctant to extend tort liability is because we've got a well-developed body of law within the Uniform Commercial Code which deals with the sale of goods. No such body of law outside the framework of tort law governs the conduct of an electrical contractor under a service contract.
Well, the predominant purpose test has been criticized also as being a test that's very difficult to apply. What response do you have to that criticism?
I think that it is true that is a difficult test to apply. However, I believe this court should develop a bright-line rule that says that in the context of a service contract, which is what we have in this case, that the economic loss doctrine will not apply because public policy does not dictate that it should. And number two, the damage to property, which is caused by the negligence of a contractor in performing services, constitutes damage to other property.
Now, although you indicate that there has to be a contract, and that's why you cannot have an economic loss doctrine on a sale of goods, and the UCC applies, cases say you don't have to have privity between the seller and the ultimate consumer to apply the economic loss doctrine.
And in those cases, it involved, I think you're talking about the Dannon case and others. Those involved, again, cases where there were specific contractual limitations on liability and recovery.
Between the person injured and the producer of the goods.
No, but there were contractual limitations between the person who was injured and the person who provided the goods. Now, look at it in the context of a service contract. This case, Cease Electric wires the barn and miswires it, thereby giving rise to a condition that ultimately would lead to the loss of these hens. And assume that S&R Egg Farms or Cold Spring sold that facility to a third party. And there was no notice or knowledge by Cold Spring of any defect in the property. So they have no liability to the third-party purchaser. Are we going to prevent that third-party purchaser from bringing a tort action against Cease Electric for their negligence in wiring the barn? That's what the economic loss doctrine just might do in this situation. Now, I'm sorry. Okay. Again, and I think this was a question that Justice Bradley raised on this issue of damage to other property. And there were some questions about what happens if the barn catches fire and the system had been integrated into the barn, et cetera. I believe an analogy can be made in the context of the Bay Breeze condominium case. That was a case where a contractor put in a window, and the window was found to be defective, and the window leaked and caused damage to the surrounding building. There the court held that the window was integrated into the building, and therefore became part of the building, and damage to the building was damage to the product. Consider for a moment what would happen if a owner went out and bought a window, a perfectly good window, and hired a contractor to put the window into their home. And the contractor did that negligently, left a strip next to the window that allowed water to infiltrate the building. And the water came in and damaged the carpeting or maybe a painting on the wall, etc. That would constitute damage to other property. And consequently, the economic loss doctrine would have no application. The contractor did not provide a product. He provided services. He was negligent. And so, therefore, under Colton, that constitutes a separate tort. And the damages which flow from his negligence were damages to the interior of the building. Indeed, even in Bay Breeze, they talk about the fact that had the water that came in from the defective window damaged the painting in the home, that would constitute damage to other property, and the economic loss doctrine wouldn't apply. Similarly, in this case, and I know this is somewhat beyond the questions that were asked by the court in granting the petition for review.
Both parties have briefed this other property issue.
Well, and I think it's appropriate for the court to address it because it's integrated into an analysis of whether or not the economic loss doctrine applies in this case. And that's what this court must decide. The court should not be giving advisory opinions as to whether or not, in some future case, the economic loss doctrine may or may not apply. But in this case, the definition of the economic loss doctrine is economic losses that do not result in or a failure of a product results in economic loss and which does not result in damage to property other than the product, and that's the language from Sunny Slope and the rest, or personal injury, because the court has reasoned that once you have damage to property other than the product or personal injury, there's no reason to limit tort liability. And that's what we have in this case. The hens in this case are other property. I suppose an argument might be made that in the event that the system failed, that the barn burned, as counsel suggested, although I don't think it's right because I don't think a system was provided. I think there was evidence that there was contracting, wiring done. There was no product provided in this case, but assuming arguendo that that is found and that is found to be integrated into the barn and that the barn burns, well, possibly there could be an economic loss doctrine argument made there because it was integrated into the barn. These chickens, these hens, have an existence totally separate from the barn or the ventilation system. They were an economic unit, much like manufacturing equipment in a manufacturing plant. If an electrician wires some lights in a manufacturing plant and the building burns down, they can argue that possibly the economic loss doctrine would apply to the loss of the building. But what about the contents? What about the machinery and the office equipment and all the other property that was damaged in the fire?
Could you summarize for me what it is that the other side is saying that they would owe if they won versus what you are entitled to if you win?
Well, I believe, and I'm not sure if I understand if you mean it under a contract theory or...
Well, we're playing with $198,000, I think it is.
That's correct.
Depending on which side wins, how does that break down or falls out?
I believe that either under the theory of tort liability or under the theory of breach of contract, and I believe both of those have been pled and proven in this case, that the entire $198,000 and change is owed by the defendants. I don't know what their position is with regard to how much they feel that they owed. I believe they take the position that if the economic loss doctrine bars this action, they don't owe anything. They owe nothing for this loss. And I think that would be wrong. I believe that based on the pleadings that we have submitted in this case, the proof that we submitted in this case, the verdict of the jury of finding negligence that we have both pled and proven, tort and contract claims, and that we're entitled to all of those damages.
If this were just a contract for goods, you know, that's not your position. Let us just say, and services are incidental. And the same thing happened. What would your client be entitled to?
The $198,000, Your Honor, because
it's contract.
Yeah.
Under Golden.
If there is a breach of contract in the providing of services for this and this product, and there has been no limitation of liability, warranty, damages, etc.
The UCC limit the liability.
And the UCC states that in the context of a sale of a product where there has not been a limitation of liability, warranty, or damages, you're entitled to the consequential damages that flow from the defect. And that's what the breach of contract damages are, and that's what the tort damages are. And I refer to jury instruction 3710, which allows the parties to recover any and all damages naturally flowing from natural and probable results of the breach.
Are our cases consistent with your theory?
I'm sorry?
Are our cases, economic loss cases, consistent with your theory?
I believe they are, Judge. I believe, Justice, I believe that that the theory behind the economic loss doctrine is to prevent parties from avoiding limitations that they've contracted for. And consistent with that, where parties to a service contract have not contracted for limited liability or providing a limited warranty with a product, that it is fully consistent with those cases to allow a party to sue for the negligent providing of those services.
The UCC doesn't cover service contracts.
That's correct.
Only product contracts.
That's correct, which is why, again, the dichotomy between the economic loss doctrine and the context of the sale of a product, we've got the UCC, which has is not only been legislated, but has a huge body of law outlining the rights and responsibilities of A, parties to the contract, B, what happens when you try to limit your liability, and C, what happens when you don't limit your liability. Similarly, there is an equal body of law dealing with parties' conduct, dealing with when I decide to go to work for you, and I don't say in the contract, because it never happens, I'm going to do A, B, and C, and I'm going to do it this way, and I'm going to do it in a workmanlike fashion. Rather, I'm going to sell you 15 windows, and I'm going to install them at $100 a window. The law imposes on me the obligation to do that reasonably, and if I don't, that's both a tort and a breach of contract. If there are no further questions, I'll sit down. Thank you very much.
Mr. Weiss.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If you should prevail, what happens to the $198,000 or the $200,000 plus?
My client keeps that money.
No remand for a trial on
no remand. No remand. Prior to trial, we raised the economic loss doctrine as a defense, saying this is a contract action. Prove and plead your contract terms and your remedies, and we'll fight about what remedies you're entitled to and fight about the proof of the ability to prove the contract breach. They chose only a tort action. They affirmatively decided to go only under tort. There was no mention in the complaint about a contract other than the contract between INA and its insured Cold Spring. There were no jury instructions on contract breach. There was no jury special verdict questions for two, negligence and costs stipulated to the amount and effect of damages. Plaintiffs are, INA admits in their briefs, page 20 of their appellate brief, that they brought only a tort action. Page 2 of their statement of facts in this court's brief admit that they brought only a tort action. They had an opportunity to amend and raise both. Just as this court recently pointed out in Van Leer, the plaintiff there had the opportunity to prove a contract claim. They chose only strict responsibility, misrepresentation. They asked for a remand. This court said, no, you had your opportunity to amend your pleadings, bring whatever claims you wanted. You affirmatively chose your theory of liability. There's nothing stopping INA, nothing stopped them or Cold Spring from amending and adding that claim. The second point I would like to raise is there is important evidence in the record about the system that was provided. We've referenced it on pages 11 and 12 of our reply brief. There is oral testimony. My client testified that it was his understanding that he provided a system. Scott Hartwig, the plan manager, testified that he believed he had a system. We made numerous record citations. And in addition, with regard to the backup thermostat was something that the plaintiffs argued in opening. They argued by introducing direct testimony from their expert and their person that we were the ones that gave them and installed the backup thermostat as part of this system that we provided.
Counselor, on page 11 and 12, you reference a system. On those pages, do you refer to the record that talks about physical objects, something I can pick up with my hand or touch with my fingers? Is that what you talk about, or are you talking about just a system?
I'm talking about the reference in the record is the system and that they provided a ventilation system and that it was our client's.
I'm interested in something I can touch. That to me is a product. A system can be anything. Maybe it's a sound system like we're having trouble with today. You know, I want to know, is there something in the record, aside from what's been mentioned so far, that I can touch if I were standing next to it? That's what I want to know.
I don't believe that there's a specific reference itemizing every part of that system.
Okay. Thank you. Why is it different than if my son would wire my computer to a monitor and he would use some wiring like was used here? That was the material. And arguing then because my son wired one thing to the other that he has delivered to me a system, even though he hasn't purchased the computer or hasn't purchased the speakers or hasn't purchased anything. And that's what you're arguing. The only evidence you have here of something you can touch is the wire and the conduit. Is that right?
And the backup thermostat, which was the testimony from the plaintiffs introduced that we provided with them, that it was effective from the day we installed it as part of this backup system, part of this ventilation system.
Your opposing counsel says, if I heard correctly and if I reviewed correctly, that there's a contest with regard to whether or not you provided that system.
I understand he takes position we didn't provide a system. It's our belief that we did provide a system with services. That's been our position.
You provided something I can touch. Let me get back to that. Did you provide anything other than the wire or the conduit?
The backup thermostat, which was lost on that day.
Okay, and your opposing counsel disagrees with that the record reflects.
Is that? Yeah, where is that?
Page 12 of our
library with record citations.
Correct.
Is your argument that if you provided one piece of equipment in the academy or multiple pieces of equipment you did not provide, that that switches this to a product case?
I've always taken the position that it is product with services.
And that the primary purpose is product under a mixed contract.
That's our position. One point that I'd like, 2 points I'd like to raise is that. I'm sorry. I didn't see that.
Just summarize your.
Basically, every service provider, even in a mixed contract, our service provider has an important interest in being able to establish the terms of the relationship that they have. The economic laws doctrine tells us we need to look to, when we have these types of issues, commercial parties, contracts, and economic laws, solely economic laws, we need to channel the recovery into contract. Look for contract remedies, if any were provided. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all of the counsel who appeared and given us further enlightenment on a difficult concept of economic loss. That will conclude our hearing in 03-0689, Insurance Company of North America versus Cease Electric, Inc.